Good afternoon, listeners. You're listening to 3CR, 855 AM on your dial, 3cr.org.au, streamed online and via the playback service. You can also listen in via the Community Radio Plus app. Now, today is May Day. We have a special segment for you over the next hour. The name of this segment is Unbroken. It's Black Unionism and the Fight for Justice. So today is May Day, as I just mentioned, and during this segment, we're going to be marking the anniversary of the historic 1946 Pilbara strike, and this May Day special will also trace the long and powerful legacy of First Nations resistance in the industrial arena. From trailblazers, like Andy Stepney, to today's formation of the BPU, we're going to expose the failings of settler unions and spotlight the resurgence of Black unionism rooted in sovereignty, solidarity and self-determination. Join us over the next hour as we reckon with the past and imagine a union movement worthy of this land. But before we talk about modern movements, before we talk about Black power today, we need to remember the warriors who came before us. The ones who stood tall in the belly of this colonial beast and said, "Not one more day of silence, not one more day of chains." One of these warriors was Andrew Stepney, known across the country as Black Andy, a name that he reclaimed and wore like armour. Black Andy was born in 1851 in Adelaide, at a time when Aboriginal people were being hunted, enslaved, and forced off our lands right across this continent. He was a proud Aboriginal man. On his mother's side, he was a Murray from Queensland. But his blood also carried the resistance of another continent. His father was a Zulu chief who had been conscripted into the British Navy. So, from birth, Black Andy was made of warriors, and he very much lived like it. Orphaned as a teenager, he survived on the streets of Melbourne. He found work where he could, on ships, in shearing sheds, and across the brutal world of pastoral labour. He saw firsthand how this colony was built. It was built on black backs, on stolen land, and with no reward but hunger and chains. But Andy didn't just work, he organised. By 1887, he had joined the Shearers' Union in Wilcannia, and by the 1890s, he was already leading actions. He participated in the 1890 Shearers' Strike at Hay. In 1894, he led unionists in a strike at Tindari Station near Cobar. He was charged with trespass, but because he dared to stand up and speak out. But Andy didn't just fight bosses. He also fought white unionists who wanted Aboriginal workers to stay invisible, to remain cheap, expendable, and silent. He demanded equal pay for black workers. He called out segregation in union camps, and he showed the world that a union is worthless if it doesn't fight for the blackfellas too. He knew what many still refuse to admit, that settler unionism has always sat on a fault line, preaching solidarity while living off stolen wages and stolen lands. Now, Black Andy wasn't just a unionist. He was one of the earliest documented Aboriginal organisers in the history of this colony. He was a man who lived and breathed sovereignty and solidarity, not as separate causes, but as one united struggle. He understood that there's no real class struggle if it doesn't include land back, cultural justice, and the end of colonial occupation. He didn't want inclusion, he wanted liberation. He represented union camps, he led strike actions, and most importantly, he led by example, unafraid, unfiltered, and unbroken. Now, sadly, Black Andy's life didn't end in glory or in statues. It ended like so many of our elders, buried in a colony that tried to forget him. But we remember, because his story is one of defiance. It's a story of clarity and a story of black power in motion. He tore the mask off of settler unionism. He forced the working class to look at themselves in the mirror, and he lit a fire that's still burning today. For every First Nations organiser today, for every young black unionist refusing to be tokenized or sidelined, Black Andy walks with us. We carry his name, we carry his courage, and his unshakable belief that justice means nothing without land, without dignity, without freedom, and without liberation. Let his story echo louder than ever this May Day, because before we had unions that saw us, before we had seats at tables, we had warriors like Black Andy who built the damn table themselves, set it on fire, and marched on anyway. Now, before we move on to the next segment, I just wanted to give a few examples of the sort of actions and praxis that Black Andy actually participated in. So he didn't just organize strikes. He actively led workers straight into the scab camps to shut them down. He very much lived by the principles of no compromise, no negotiation, just direct collective power. Now, when bosses brought in scabs, Andy made sure they didn't have an opportunity to get comfortable. He led striking shearers to confront them head on, forcing these scab workers off the stations and back across the lines. Where white union leaders hesitated, Andy took action. So if a camp was full of scabs breaking the strike, Andy would rally the workers and march in, not with petitions or anything like that, but would march in with his fists and with fire and would physically remove these scab workers from these scab camps. Andy very much understood that scabs weren't just strike breakers. They were people who were upholding the same colonial system that oppressed black workers, so he treated them like the enemies of the people that they actually are. Now, we're going to go to a quick song. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Pilbara strike, and we're going to really dive into the Pilbara strike. For those who don't know, the Pilbara strike actually kicked off on the 1st of May back in 1946, 79 years ago today.
OJ, this for Central Cali right here. Yeah, 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 yeah. Keep the pork from out my rice. Immigration ain't an issue for the right, cause it ain't right to have the right to keep the laws in favor of the job creator. When the job creator ship a factory for cheaper labor, labor low enough to keep the people quiet and complacent. When the money's getting spent right on the soil that's adjacent to the place where they are starving. So hop a fence. Coffee in my blood will keep the dogs up off my scent. Skin color versus the board of education. If you ain't catch that line, then you should study segregation. This is rap mediation. Time to snap you right back into place, cause they've been begging for some shit from back before 2008. I'm thinking 1998. 90 crates with two turntables. Round the time your Auntie Merle put a tattoo on her ankle talking ratchet. When ratchet was escaping all the drama, back when we could work for honor, working a blue collar. I am from a different time, uphold a different code. I hope we are connected, I don't know, cause I know a couple people listening is dealing with some real shit. Real shit, feel like packing up your shit and skipping town for a bit. I'll throw you in my carry-on and we can take a trip where we can snorkel with the fish and hear some real rap shit. Make love in the sand over some real rap shit. I'm a career MC, working on minimum wage. Make the brothers yell rap, the sisters say A, make the sisters say rap. The brothers yell A, make the brothers yell rap. Say, I hit the stage and leave a crater size of meteorites. The sound man getting pissed, he think I'm cupping the mic. But it's just me and my projection like an RPG to shoot a unmanned drone into the goddamn sea. You faint a heart, then this the part that you should stop the CD. Those rappers who claim they feel you were lying on TV. Megaphone, a type of truth inside a low budget booth. Easy feet to feel what I do till I lose in my tooth. I don't shoot like unprofessionals, ducking, eyes closed. They're shaking up by the liberals, talking about gun control. Cause I know it's as simple as a power plant. Closing. Y'all don't know how to preserve your food if it ain't frozen. Y'all been screaming all that gun right, ready for revolt, but couldn't filter out the rain to clean some water to go. Grab a pen and try your hardest to imagine that the tip by the size that you alone even matters in all of this. Cause I'm a career MC on minimum wage. Make the brothers yell rah, the sisters say ay. Make the brothers yell, the sisters say, the brothers yell, the sisters yell. I'm from a different time and I uphold a different code. I hope we are connected, I don't know. I know a couple people listening is dealing with some real shit. Yeah. real shit. Feel like packing up your shit and skipping town for a bit. I'll throw you in my carry-on and we can take a trip. Drinking drinks inside a hut and hearing real rap shit. Cliff diving in the ocean over real rap shit. Real rap shit. This that real rap shit. Central Cali, what's up? Southern Cali, what's up? North Cal, what's up? Whole world, what's up? Philippines, what's up? Bruh. Yeah.
That was Minimum Wage by Bamboo. Bamboo is a Filipino-American rapper from LA. He's got a really great discography, a lot of really great songs around, class struggle, liberation, and all the contradictions of stuff like colonization and capitalism. If you haven't heard of him before, really recommend you go and check out some of his other work. Now, for this next section, we're going to be having a bit of a yarn about the Pilbara Strike. Now, the Pilbara Strike is one of the most powerful and one of the most under-recognized acts of Aboriginal resistance in so-called Australia's history, an act that began on this day 79 years ago. Now, the Pilbara Strike wasn't just a strike, it was a black-led uprising. It was a rejection of colonial slavery, and it was a clear declaration that our sovereignty cannot be co-opted, negotiated, or delayed. Now, a bit of the colonial context behind this all. In 1946, over 800 Aboriginal workers, mostly from the Pilbara region of so-called Western Australia, walked off pastoral stations in what would become one of the longest industrial actions in this colony's entire history. But let's be really clear here. These were not employees in any proper sense. Aboriginal workers were unpaid, undervalued, and enslaved. They were paid in flour, tea, tobacco, and sugar. These same sort of ration payments are the exact same thing that we see when we look at other enslaved black people from across the globe and throughout history. They were moved around as well, very much like cattle. They were punished, they were surveilled, and they were often beaten into submission. And this was all protected. It was protected by law, protected by the colonial police, and protected by the pastoral economy that built the West Australian colony off of my people's backs and my people's labour. Now, this strike was very much led by lawmen and by warriors. It's not a strike that came from unions. Very important distinction here. This strike did not come from the unions. It did not come from the parliaments. It did not come from the Australian Labor Party. It came from Aboriginal law, from a cultural and political authority older than any colonial institution in the world. Now, the strike was led by people such as Dooley Binbin and Clancy McKenna, two Aboriginal lawmen with deep roots in the country and in the people that they defended. They worked alongside Don McLeod, who was a white communist and an ally, but make no mistake here, McLeod followed black leadership. He supported, but he didn't lead. He knew who held the real power and authority in this movement, and that was our old people. Now, the idea for the strike was formed in 1942, during a massive law meeting at Skull Springs. Now, this law meeting had different language groups, different nations, different laws, all coming together under a shared cultural law to all say that enough is enough. We need to do something about this. They planned it carefully, and they chose May 1st, International Workers' Day, to show that the Aboriginal struggle was also a class struggle. But it was a class struggle to be had on stolen land, and that piece of context changes everything. This was organized black resistance. Now, on May Day 1946, the strike launched. Workers walked off stations across the Pilbara. They built their own independent bush camps, and they refused to return. They created self-sufficient operations, you know, doing stuff like cutting wood, collecting food, mining their own minerals, forming their own co-ops. This was black economic autonomy in action. They relied on stuff like the Bush Telegraph, on stuff like kinship networks, and on cultural law to keep the strike alive and coordinated across these very vast distances. And we're talking very vast distances here, you know, hundreds of kilometers. And this is a line that they held for more than 3 years. Very, very long time to be on strike, to be holding pickets and blockades, and to, you know, go without all those rations, the so-called pay, but, you know, to go without all these rations and without all these other concessions and handouts from the colony, but to build, you know, your own self-independence as a part of that strike. It's very, very inspiring and something that is not modelled today. Now, you know, predictably, the colony responded very much with violence to all of this. Strikers were arrested, they were whipped, they were dragged literally in chains before colonial courts. We had stuff like the police raiding camps. We had white station owners lobbying for new laws to force black workers back into servitude. You know, stuff like vagrancy charges, stuff like, you know, legalizing wage theft, and all of the other legal harassment that went against First Nations striking workers. But these people, they didn't break. The settler union movement, though, it was silent. Or even worse, it was hostile. White workers did not want Aboriginal labour organising itself. They saw us as a threat to their position within this colonial order. So let's be very clear here. This strike exposed the true nature of the settler working class. Always ready to call for solidarity when it benefits them, but just as ready to defend their privilege when we step into power. Now, don't get me wrong, they weren't all bad. You know, one of the only unions, I just want to repeat that bit, because, you know, it's not like all of the unions were lining up to assist us. One of the only unions that actually stood in true solidarity with the Pilbara strikers was the Seamen's Union. Now, the Seamen's Union done stuff like enforce black bans on the export of wool and other goods out of the Pilbara region, and, you know, that were connected to this strike, which very much disrupted the colonial economy, and it really hurt that colonial economy as well. But I want to make something really clear here. I want us all to be very clear. This wasn't because the Seamen's Union was some uniquely principled union amongst all the other settler unions. It was because the Seamen's Union was a union made up largely of migrants, refugees, and workers from other colonized nations. It was made up of people with a lived understanding of imperialism, racism, and exploitation. The Seamen's Union was made up of people who worked regularly alongside black and brown workers right across the globe, so of course their politics were a lot more internationalist. They weren't based on that colonial nationalism like so many of the other unions of the day and even today. But that is why the Seamen's Union saw our struggle as their own. They didn't see it as charity or allyship, but solidarity across borders beneath the same empire. So, you know, we really do have to look at the nuances and the context behind support from the union movements for First Nations movements, because there is a lot of context and a lot of nuance there. And it's very easy to get caught up in these traps of assuming that, you know, all of the union movements have always been great for First Nations people and have always been there to support us. But that's not the case. And it is very much the case, you know, just like this Seamen's Union, where when we actually delve into it and we actually look at the nuance and the context behind it, we look at who was actually involved in that support for First Nations resistance and struggles, we quite often see that it's other black and brown workers, you know, other people who are refugees or migrants or have other lived experience of imperialism and colonialism themselves. You know, it's not a bunch of white settler unionists coming and standing with us because it's the right thing to do. It is very often people with similar lived experiences standing with us because they know what it's like. Now, this is a very important distinction to be made, and honestly, it's a distinction that still very much exists even today. But we're going to get a bit more into today's union movement and the state of it a bit later in the program. I want to keep talking about the Pilbara strike. There's another person I want to talk about in particular who was connected to this. And this person was one of the most important leaders in this movement, although this person has often been erased in the colonial retelling. Their name was Daisy Bindi. Now, I'm really sorry if I mispronounce this. It's not a nation or a clan that I am very familiar with, but Daisy was a Nyanamara woman. I think that's maybe how you pronounce it. Apologies if I'm wrong. But yeah, Daisy was a Nyanamara woman, and she didn't just walk off the station. She was somebody who led one of the most critical and boldest actions of the strike itself. Now, Daisy was somebody who confronted the managers at Roy Hill Station, where she rounded up more than 90 Aboriginal workers and marched them all out of that station together. And then she went even further. She done stuff like went around to other stations where she... She's also someone who's very credited with having this amazing... gift of speech and being really great at being able to, talk her way into things and out of things and through things, etc., etc. But yeah, she went around to all of these other stations as well. And at quite a lot of them, she actually managed to convince a lot of these white station owners to give up some of the wages that they had been holding, you know, these stolen wages for their First Nations workers. She convinced quite a lot of them to, you know, pay up what was owed. And it was those funds that actually enabled the survival of the strike camps and allowed them to get, you know, the resources they needed, the food they needed, you know, the, stuff to build shelters and clothes and whatever else. Now, there's also another really great example of her amazing speech abilities. Daisy was somebody who could actually sneak striking black workers through police barricades. Now, there's actually a few records of her doing this, of her driving a truck, and in the back of the truck, she would have all these striking black fellow workers, and, you know, they'll get to these police barricades, police checkpoints and whatever else, where the cops weren't letting striking workers through, and, you know, weren't allowing these Aboriginal people to leave these missions and these stations. But she'll get there and she would actually con the cops, and the cops would end up letting her through with a truck full of blackfellas in the back. So, you know, a very, very amazing speech. And this is at a time when, you know, genocide and massacres and slavery and, you know, beatings and all these other horrible things were very commonplace in, you know, a part of our everyday lives. So it's, you know, the extra context there is, it's just, it's really a really amazing to read about and to hear about. Now, Daisy travelled quite far across the country. She done a lot of really great work mobilising other communities, gathering supplies, and keeping the spirits of the striking workers going strong. Pardon me. She defied not only the bosses, but she was also someone who was able to defy the misogyny and the patriarchal attitudes in her own movement that very much tried to limit women's leadership. Daisy Bindi showed us what true power looks like, a black woman leading her people out of bondage and into resistance. Now, again, you know, if you haven't heard of Daisy Bindi, please, you know, do, after this show, go and do some reading yourself. Read up about her. She's quite an amazing and influential figure in the resistance history of this continent. Now, back to the Pilbara strike, though, overall. So, you know, the strike didn't end with a total victory, but that was never the only point. You know, yes, the wages improved slightly, and yes, you know, the spotlight hit WA's abuse of Aboriginal workers, but more importantly, the Pilbara strike planted the seed of sovereign black worker power. It gave us a model of what it looks like when we walk away from the colonial economy, when we build on our own terms, and when we defend our dignity through collective withdrawal and refusal. It inspired later movements such as the Gurindji Walk-Off of 1966, the land rights movements of the 70s and 80s, and even more recently, the emergence of unions like the Black People's Union. So, you know, a really strong lesson from this to remember is, and you know, what the Pilbara Strike teaches us is that the bosses and the state will, of course, always stand together, that the white worker will often choose settler comfort over solidarity, that liberation comes not from the ballot box, but from the fire of resistance, and that sovereignty doesn't wait for permission, it acts. We're not asking for better jobs on stolen land, we're building a new world, one rooted in land back, labour justice and black power. In 1946, Aboriginal workers didn't just go on strike, they withdrew from the colony. They refused to prop it up, they built outside of it, and in doing so, they showed us the way forward. So, you know, let their courage echo in every strike, in every walk-off, and every refusal to cooperate within settler power today. Because this is not over, this is ongoing, and this is unbroken.
We the movement, more than music. Winning all these battles, man, we no longer losing. We the people, organizing, door to door knocking, waking up the uprising. See, we the movement, more than music. Winning all these battles, man, we no longer losing. See, I'm a rebel, man, it's so contagious. They don't even really want me in their job placements. It's outrageous, they are so racist. The system needs a facelift, we need some real changes. Land and education, it's so basic. No need for liquor, homie, it's success that I'm chasing. I no longer fight the struggle, I embrace it. Remix the movement, add a bit of flavor. Add a bit of hood to it, that'll do some good to it. Add a little rage, and add a little sugar to it. Add a little Huey P, mix it up with you and me. Black and brown unity, always under scrutiny. We starting up a mutiny. No to impunity, yes to my community, yes to my community. The harder they come, boy, the harder they fall. So we throw them overboard while we on a world tour. Doing something lucrative, still remain righteous. I'm Davis and Midas. Feel the sensation, but no, it's not permanent. Roots in the nation, but never put permanent. Add a little swerve to it, and two-step with it. Got my eyes on the prize, and that's definite. Prize is my life and my rights and my freedom. The clothes and the houses, the cars are misleading. American dream is depletion. Wanna get you so hooked that you're too fiend to defeat them. Power in believing, power in your liberation, power in your reading, power in your education, power to the people in the steeple. I can hear you bringing power to the people through the people. I can see you changing. All the places you will go, all your troubles out the door. No more speeding, take it slow, slow, slow. Probably headed to the shy. In New York, rarely go below 125. Fuck town, baby. If I ain't here, I'm out the door. On the Triborough, headed to the airport. On the go to the show, IDs and passports. No pauses, fast forward, no sleep between tours. On the grind, trying to build young minds. Sometimes I lose mine, stressing the lack of dollar signs. But I know, Rye said it before. Gotta fund the revolution on our own accord. Ain't no Ford Foundation gon' change the nation. Ain't no profit corporation gon' erase racism. It's built in to the system they defend. How we gon' win if we so entrenched? Instead, I'm off the grid, solar powered electric. So everywhere I go, across the globe, I'm connected. We the movement, more than music. Winning all these battles, man, we no longer losing. We the people.
people organizing, door to door knocking, waking up the uprising.
That was We The Movement by Rebel Diaz. Now, if you've been listening to this segment of the May Day broadcast, we've been talking a bit about the history of First Nations resistance and trade union movements here on this continent, in this colony. In particular, we had a bit of a discussion about Andy Stepney, or Black Andy as he was known at the time, one of, if not the first, recorded First Nations unionists and organizers in this colony. And we also had a bit of a yarn about the Pilbara strike and the sort of groundwork that the Pilbara strike laid for First Nations resistance, especially in the industrial arena, but generally speaking as well, about First Nations resistance today. Now, for the rest of the program, we're going to be bringing it forward to the present and having a bit of a yarn about the current state of trade unions and the trade union movement here in the Australian colony. And for this next segment as well, I'm going to be joined by a good friend and comrade of mine from the BPU, Alana. Alana is somebody who I have quite a lot of discussions and quite a lot of debates and interesting chats with around politics in general, but in particular the trade union movement as well here in this colony. I think I'll just hand the microphone over to Alana to give herself a bit of an introduction.
Thanks, Kieran. So my name is Alana. As Kieran said, I'm an associate member of the Black People's Union. I was the first associate member, I believe, to be admitted to the BPU, and I've organised with them for the past 2-3 years. I don't profess to be any kind of expert in trade unionism, but, you know, I know a few things. I was an organizer with the Health and Community Services Union, and I've also been a union delegate in quite a few of my workplaces as well.
Thank you for that. And yeah, actually you were. You were the first associate member to be admitted to the BPU. And look, you know, you might not profess to be much of a expert or anything like that, but, you know, at the end of the day, I think objectively you have quite a lot of experience and quite a lot of knowledge, which really contributes to the discussions that we're about to have about this stuff. So, you know, at least for me, I think it's an honour to have you on the show here with me. So I guess, you know, we might just dive straight into it. I've got a few different talking points that I wanted to bring up over this next section of this segment. But yeah, first off, you know, I want to talk about how settler unions ultimately still serve the colony. Now, you know, despite all of this progressive branding, most trade unions in this colony still operate as instruments of colonial stability. Their priority remains protecting the economic position of settlers, not dismantling the system that exploits and occupies Indigenous lands. And, you know, they might speak the language of solidarity, but when black land, black lives, and black labour are at stake, they quite often fall silent, retreat, or oppose us outright.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to make about settler unions. And I think, you know, a really uncomfortable feeling that's very difficult for settlers to sit with, and especially white settlers to sit with, is that, you know, settler unions in many ways, they are still enacting white supremacy. And you can see this in the way that, as you've just said, they are terrified of black liberation. When it comes to, as you say, black land, black lives, and black labor, they fall silent or they oppose liberation entirely.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that really ties into the next point as well about the whole colonial chauvinism in unionism. Now, you know, what I'm talking about here is how settler unions continue to display colonial chauvinism, dismissing First Nations struggles as stuff like niche or divisive. Now, when we speak about land back, for example, or reparations or First Nations-led organising, we're quite often met with suspicion, with accusations of separatism, or with outright hostility. You know, their vision of worker unity too often relies on us being silent, us being absorbed, and us abandoning our sovereignty for the comfort of white left consensus. Now, I've had a lot of personal experience with this, in particular myself. You know, when we first started the Black People's Union, quite a lot of people who at the time I considered to be comrades and even friends, settlers I'm talking about here, they came to me with all of these, you know, so-called concerns about how by starting the Black People's Union, I was splitting the union movement and I was being divisive and I was causing all of these other issues, and more or less asking me, you know, if you're so passionate about First Nations people being involved in unions, why aren't you pushing First Nations people to join the unions that already exist? And, you know, it's such an oxymoronic question, because obviously, why would I do that? Why would I push people to go and join these institutions that uphold the colony and that quite often are very racist institutions just for the sake of, you know, unity and peace for settlers? Not for my people, but for settlers. And look, at the end of the day, these are very colonial and racist institutions. You know, I can tell you now, as the previous president of the BPU, pretty much every single First Nations worker who has reached out to the BPU for some sort of trade union support, they didn't come to us first. They actually went to their respective trade unions first, and every single one of them was not just let down by their trade union, but was actively thrown under the bus. They had trade union delegates go and, you know, have all these meetings with racist managers and bosses and whatever else, and actively throw the First Nations worker under the bus for the sake of, you know, peace and the sake of unity and not rustling too many waves and feathers and whatever else. So that's why they end up coming to the BPU in the first place. It's because their actual trade unions were these racist institutions, or at the very least, practice racism against these people and let them down. So there is very much a need for organisations like the BPU to exist in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think something that settler leftists, particularly white settler leftists, don't think about or can't come to terms with, or, you know, can't just sit with, is how deep that colonial chauvinism is embedded, you know, in our politics, in our principles, and how often our behavior and our actions and even just our attitudes are actually really violent and oppressive and re-traumatizing for our Black and Indigenous comrades. And that so often when our comrades come to us for help, or come to their unions for help, or go to their workplace delegate for help, they don't get that help. What they get is more violence, more oppression, and more trauma.
Yeah, and look, I think as well, just for like the listeners to really hone this point down and like drive this point home sort of thing, right? We know that something like 75% of all Australians hold anti-Indigenous sentiments. And we know that that figure is true regardless of somebody's political beliefs, regardless of their gender, their age, their education, etc., etc. You know, when we say 75% of Australians hold racist anti-Indigenous beliefs, that also includes trade union workers. That includes your, you know, so-called lefties and your so-called socialists and communists and whatever else. It includes those who, you know, should know better because they have university-level degrees and whatever else. You know, it's very much ingrained, you know, as you're saying, it's so ingrained in the society. It's, you know, as we've often talked about on this program and elsewhere, you know, to be Australian is to be anti-Indigenous. You cannot separate the two. They go hand in hand together.
Yeah, and as a white person who has been active in unions and in so-called progressive workplaces, I've had to reckon with how deeply that colonial chauvinism runs. And I've seen firsthand how First Nations struggles are written off, as you say, as divisive, or they're dismissed as something separate from the class struggle, as though the theft of land and the violence of the colony and the ongoing dispossession of Aboriginal people isn't foundational to the economy that we're organising in. So when black comrades talk about land back or reparations or leading their own organising work, it makes a lot of settlers, but particularly white settlers, deeply uncomfortable. And instead of sitting with that discomfort and listening, people default to defensiveness. As you say, you know, calling black liberation separatist or unstrategic, or saying that it alienates the broader working class, when really what they mean is it alienates white workers. That's what they mean. And this idea of worker unity gets thrown around a lot, but more often than not, it's unity on white people's terms. It's white terms. And unity that asks Indigenous people to abandon sovereignty, to assimilate into, you know, a settler-led vision of liberation, that's not unity. You know, real solidarity means letting go of control. It means centering First Nations leadership, not absorbing it into the comfort of, you know, white consensus. And I think that's something that a lot of people need to unlearn.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, something you've said there as well, really is a great link to the next point, which is about the historical portrayals and how they remain unaddressed. So, you know, these unions that we're talking about have never meaningfully reckoned with their own historical complicity in Indigenous dispossession, you know, be it through support for settler industry, silence during massacres, or racial exclusion in membership. The same unions that once fought to exclude black workers now hold panels about, you know, so-called diversity without ever actually addressing the harm or relinquishing the power that they have as a result of our occupation and genocide.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, unions in this colony have historically backed settler industries that stole land and exploited Aboriginal labour, or they, you know, stayed silent during massacres or actively excluded black and other non-white workers. This is not ancient history. That is the foundation of unionism in this country. And now these same unions, you know, will run panels about diversity without ever naming the past, let alone repairing the harm or shifting the power structures that were built off it. It is tokenistic and it's dishonest. If we're serious about solidarity, then we have to confront the fact that the union movement in this colony has a history of protecting white labour at the expense of Indigenous sovereignty and black workers' rights.
And, you know, it's not even just the history as well. It's very tied into the present. Now, I'm not going to name any names, CPSU, but, you know, we still have unions today that represent prison workers who murder our people in custody. You know, up in the Northern Territory, for example, it was actually union delegates that advocated for the reintroduction of spit hoods into juvenile detention centres. You know, how disgusting is that? We have unionists, or, you know, so-called progressives out here advocating for prison guards to be able to spit hood our children like they're in Guantanamo Bay. You know, absolutely disgusting behavior from some of these unions today. And again, like I just said, when there's a death in custody, when a prison worker is, you know, held to account, or when we try to hold them to account, because we've never actually been able to properly hold them to account, but when we try and hold a murderous prison worker to account, it's unions that represent government workers that actually go and support and represent these murderous screws. You know, this isn't history we're talking about only. We're also very much talking about the present. But look, we are running out of time and there's a few things I want to cover here. So I'm going to move on to the next point, which is how the Accords were a death blow to union power. So, you know, the so-called Prices and Incomes Accords of the 1980s were very much championed by the ALP and the ACTU, and they effectively neutered the union movement. Unions traded away strike power, wage increases, and autonomy in exchange for a seat at the colonizers' capitalist table, under the condition that they never bite the hand that feeds them. The result today is we have a union movement domesticated, toothless, and dependent on Labour Party patronage. Now, not only that, you know, we have a union movement today that is at one of, if not the lowest it has ever been in this colony's history. I think we have something like a 10% or less union membership rate within workforces. But not only that, those unions that are there and those unionists that are there, they're scared. They're afraid to do anything. Do you know how many rallies and blockades and pickets and whatever else I've been at where we've had members from, you know, the so-called staunchest unions like CFMEU and MUA getting up talking about how they can't do anything because if they do, they'll have to face all these fines and they might be deregistered. You know, and like, to really put this in context, these are blockades and pickets and actions against Israel and in support of Palestine, against genocide, against the bombing of innocent children. And we have union officials that are afraid to be fined out of existence. Meanwhile, we have children, and in fact, we have an entire ethnic group, the Palestinians in Gaza, being bombed out of existence. This is, you know, the comparison here that we're trying to make. And I suppose tied to that whole, you know, accords and stuff as well, is how modern unions are very much a bureaucracy over struggle. Many unions today are bureaucratic shells, more focused on compliance, on branding, and on electoral cycles than actual industrial action. The average worker is alienated from these institutions. And, you know, as I said before, something like 10% of people, 10% of workers, are unionists. The other 90% alienated from it. The energy has been drained from below and redirected into parliamentary lobbying and internal processes. And even when they do act, it's often only symbolic. It is designed to be palatable to governments and businesses, and it's not designed to be disruptive, militant, or revolutionary. Something else I really want to talk about as well, real quickly, is the unionist support for the Zionist Voice to Parliament referendum. Now, back in 2023, almost every major union lined up behind the Zionist Conservative Voice to Parliament referendum. They willingly aligned themselves with settler politicians, with Zionist think tanks, and with mining corporations, framing it as a step towards justice. But blackfellas organising under our sovereignty through, you know, organisations like the BPU, the Black Sovereign Movement, through countless other grassroots movements, we rejected the referendum as the colonial trap that it was. But instead of listening, the unions doubled down. They labelled people divisive, extreme, and ungrateful for not wanting to go along with a conservative Zionist agenda. And again, you know, they showed whose interests they really serve, and that being the interests of the colony, of the Labour Party, and of all of these lobby groups.
Yeah, I think that the Voice to Parliament referendum in 2023 was definitely a turning point because of how clearly it exposed the fault lines in, you know, so-called progressive spaces, and especially and particularly in the union movement, because almost every major union lined up behind the Yes campaign, you know, not just to support it, but to champion it and frame it as the path to justice. They aligned themselves with mining corporations, ALP politicians, and Zionist think tanks without blinking. As, you know, a white person who's been part of these unionist spaces, it really made me reflect deeply on how quick we are, white people, to confuse comfort for justice and to accept, you know, symbolic inclusion while rejecting actual power shifts.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And, you know, it really makes you wonder, like, what's the point of these unions anyways if they're just going to be vessels and institutions to push ALP propaganda, knowing full well that the ALP is not a working party. It's not actually a party that supports labour rights. It's a party that supports capitalism and colonisation. And in fact, it supports imperialism as well, right across the entire global south. I think as well, you know, this is a great segue into the next point that we wanted to talk about, which was the formation of the BPU. You know, the BPU was a organization that was very much born from the betrayal of the trade union movement here in so-called Australia. Not just the betrayal in terms of the voice to parliament, because we formed before the voice to parliament, but the betrayal in general of the trade union movement here. You know, we emerged out of a recognition that settler unions would never prioritize black liberation, because doing so would actually require them to dismantle the very system that privileges them. The BPU is a First Nations-led revolutionary formation built on the principles of sovereignty, survival, and self-determination. You know, it's not an organization asking for representation. It's an organization looking to build power outside of these colonial structures on our own terms. And that very much includes these trade unions as well. Because, you know, people might not like this framing, but at the end of the day, they are colonial structures. And they're in bed with the ALP, one of the main two colonial parties running this entire colony.
Yeah, I think that settlers, and again, particularly white settlers, just need to sit with the discomfort and the reality that our unions in this colony are not neutral. They are actively invested in the stability of the colonial state. They are actively invested in the ongoing existence of this colonial state.
Which is, again, an excellent segue into the next point I wanted to talk about, which is the complicity here, because they're very actively complicit, and look, sorry, these are two different words I know, but you know, they're actively involved in this, but they're also very complicit in it as well. So trade unions are very much complicit in land theft and extractivism. You know, they continue to defend projects that actually destroy our country, projects like mines, pipelines, ports, etc., because they're, you know, apparently good for jobs. They also frame land defense as anti-worker or anti-development, betraying the fact that they see the colony's economy as natural and permanent. And for us, you know, these projects mean desecration. They mean death. They mean forced removal and forced displacement from our country. A just transition must begin with returning land and wealth, not expanding the settler economy. But these trade unions are very geared towards just that, expanding the settlers' economy here in so-called Australia. Now, the next point I want to talk about is how resistance isn't welcome until it's safe. So what I mean by this is First Nations voices are often invited into union spaces only when we're non-threatening. If we speak out too strongly, if we challenge their leadership, or if we name the violence of the state, we're dismissed, we're sidelined, and we're labelled divisive. Unions want the aesthetics of solidarity, but not the demands that come with it. Demands like land back, power sharing, reparations, and our sovereignty.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Something that I've had to confront and, you know, still unlearn is how much comfort is built into whiteness, even in these supposedly radical spaces. I've been in union meetings, political collectives, activist groups where Indigenous people are welcomed in, but only if they're seen as non-threatening, only if they don't challenge the leadership or the agenda or, you know, the general settler framework that the group operates within. But the moment someone names the violence of the state or calls for land back or critiques that union's complicity in colonialism, they're sidelined. They're dismissed. And I've seen this happen in real time over and over again. I've seen white people get uncomfortable when that resistance doesn't make room for us or doesn't flatter our sense of, you know, allyship. I think the truth is that many unions want the image of solidarity, the NAIDOC poster, the Welcome to Country, the Black Speak on the Diversity Panel, but they don't want to make the actual material concessions that solidarity requires. That means land back. That means power sharing. That means giving up control. And we need to actually name this. As a, you know, white comrade, if I'm serious about decolonization, I have to be willing to feel that discomfort and not center myself in it. I have to listen when black organizers tell me what solidarity actually looks like and act on it, even when it challenges the institutions that I was taught to trust. In fact, especially then.
Yep, exactly. And you know what? This is a perfect segue, again, into our final point that I wanted to talk about today, which is that the future must be black-led. If the union movement is to have a future that's worth anything, it must be decolonized, it must be militarized, and it must be black-led. That means supporting First Nations resistance without conditions, stepping aside where necessary, and confronting the class colonial contradictions that they refuse to face. True solidarity isn't symbolic, it's risk-taking, power-sharing, and a commitment to decolonization, no matter how uncomfortable it makes the settler left here in so-called Australia.
On the 20th of February 1987, Clinton McIrvin was murdered. His killers are still at large. I'm fed up with the fact that when police kill a black, they never seem to get charged. We've had enough. In a Wolverhampton there was a killing, police murder Clinton McIrvin. In a shop called Next was where the murder begin. Then say a stolen credit card he was using. Before me carry on, do some thinking. If you had the credit card which was stolen, and then tell you say wait, make me do some checking. You nah stand up in the shop like a damn ding-a-ling. So why him never move and do some running? Well maybe it was his offie in my drain. You know the police will say anything, cut to them you is a thief if you have black skin. But anyway, to dirty Babylonian Russian, jump on the yacht and I sit down pan him. Draw back in me and bust a yacht neck string, and a kin feed them teeth like them kill a chicken. He was only young, lad, what a sin. He should be walking round but he's in a coffin. Then don't treat we as human beings, so we better get together and do something. We've had enough. We've had enough a hit, no. We've had enough a hit, we've had enough a hit. Not taking no more, we've had enough, lad. We've had enough a hit, we've had enough a hit, we've had enough a hit. All over England, it is happening. At the hands of police, blacks get a beating. Cherry Gross paralyzed, your police shooting. Then beat Trevor Manville and brain damage him. Cynthia Jarrett was another victim. Them push a down killer when them was reading. Them say Colin Rhodes shoot himself just for nothing. Keith Leonard, the list is never ending. Then get 3 man life for the break like killing. Convict the man before the trial did begin. Use them as scapegoat, throw them in the bin. But when police kill a black man, they not do a thing. Me yet they dot the base and I get under my skin. Every time me say one, me feel fi cuff him. But me know say we have to do some organizing, cause this a war in a Babylon and we are going. We've had enough, we've had enough a hit. No, we've had enough a hit, we've had enough a hit. Not taking no more, we've had enough, lad. We've had enough a hit, we've had enough a hit, we've had enough a hit. Well the next could be you, or it could be me. Could be your brother, could be your auntie. Could be your friend, could be your pickaninny. So what we need now is solidarity. Some black man no care, cause them life cozy. But when police bust them head, who them run to? No we support one another, give one unity. Physically, spiritually, and financially. Unity is strength, organizing is the key. That's why Babylon tried to separate we. But we are African children and we are mighty. We have to control our own destiny. So when it comes to business, all away. When it comes to support, then all away. If it comes to war, then all away. Then they might think twice before they kill we pick me. Then take the chain off our foot, but we still don't free. No far away under mental slavery. That's why you don't know yourself and your identity. You don't know your friend from your enemy. We people them are dying in Africa daily. Babylon not change, so we sat down to we. Freedom and justice are we priority. Just listen to the words of Messiah Gabi. Fight me to a weak nation, and I will show you a people abused, taken advantage of by others. Show me a weak race, and I will show you a people and a nation reduced to peonage, serfdom, and slavery. Show me a well-organized nation, and I will show you a people and a nation respected by the world. Organizing is the key.
Thanks again for joining me for that discussion, Alana. That is the conclusion of this segment of the Mayday broadcast. You're listening to 3CR, 855 AM on your dial, 3cr.org.au, streamed online and via the playback service. Stay tuned. We've got more of the Mayday broadcast coming up next. Have a good one.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.